a very popular song, actually, a kind of a cut in on a, so many Galway songs, including Galway Bay, but yes, it depicts indeed big changes in Galway. That's where our guest comes from in Galway. I want to tell you a little bit, though, about Paul Finnegan. Paul, of course, he is the director of the New York Irish Center here in Long Island City in Queens. We've known Paul, and so has the community, for give or take 25 years. And long before there was a center for the Irish and non-Irish alike, our guest, Paul, was executive director of the Emerald Isle, put in about 4 years there. Paul, you're very welcome.
Hi, Adrian. Pleasure to be on your show this morning.
Paul, a little bit about yourself and Galway. You grew up. Tell us about your early days and your growing up in the west of Ireland.
Well, the full story actually begins, and most people kind of are surprised when I tell them, and then they forget because it never seems to connect. But I was actually born out in Arizona, and my parents, my father was a civil engineer when he was working, and he had a job down in Arizona, and some of my siblings were born there. But they had planned to move back to Ireland when my mother became pregnant with myself, and they decided to wait it out till I was born. So as soon as I was born, actually, within 2 weeks, they put me on a plane, and they took me to Galway. So I had no early memories of my time in Phoenix. And I was born in November and home in my grandmother's kitchen by Christmas Day that year. So, but from then on, it was all Galway City. My father's people basically came after coming in from Connemara. They lived right in the heart of Galway City, a place called Wood Quay, in the shadow of Galway Cathedral there. So it doesn't get more Galway City than Wood Quay. But from then on, you know, we eventually settled in Renmore, which was a parish just on the east side of town, where the army barracks is. And pretty much most of my life, I grew up in Renmore, Galway. And I went to there was a national school there, still is, called Scoil Catriona. And then I went to St. Joseph's in town for secondary school, which they called the Bish.
Yeah.
And then it was on to what was then called UCG. Now National University of Ireland at Galway, and from then it was it was the middle of the 80s. I graduated college and looked around, and there wasn't a job to be found the length and breadth of the country at that time. So I said, you know what, I'll head back to the States. It was a nice out for me at the time, but I went with a group of. Actually, it was quite an extensive amount of my friends left Galway at that time. Many went to England, but a huge number came over to the States, to New York and Boston. So basically, my real experience of America became just part of the Irish community in New York starting the 1980s. So that's the bit of a summary.
Okay. I didn't know that you're a born Yank. I assume your father and mother, what was the Galway connection then, when they...
My father was from Galway. My mother actually was born and raised in Kilkenny. But her parents were teachers. One of them was from East Galway, near the Ballinasloe area. And her mother was from East Galway. Her father was from West Cork. So I'm 75% Galway and 25% Cork, actually.
Yeah.
So, but they being teachers, they met in Kilkenny in the same schoolhouse in Kilkenny and got married, had a family and everything. And so, a bunch of girls and boys, and two of my uncles became priests, and one became a nun. So it was, and they all went on the missions. So I had lots of stories of the missions in my childhood as well.
Yeah,
boxes right. of African ornaments and exotic things from the Far East. My two uncles became Columbans, and my aunt became a medical missionary of Mary. So you know, there was just and about being born in the States, there's a lot of us around, Adrian. I even meet them like in during the 80s, a lot of the people I, you know, in the community had started families and then availed of the Celtic Tiger, went back to Ireland, and then when the recession came, the most recent recession came, you know, 2008, a lot of the kids came back to America because they had citizenship and there was less opportunity in Ireland for a few years there. But again, that's changing again.
We should
form a society or an association. But it wouldn't be unheard of, Adrian, for me to tell you this again in 2 years and you will have forgotten.
Yeah, well, I'm putting a notch here, and you know, on the broadcast board. I'm not sure. I don't want to that one again. I would like you to, you know, address the change. A lot of people who in the 50s and 60s and 70s, when they came to the United States, they didn't really plan to stay. There was always that hope that maybe they would return when Ireland's economy was better. Just in your own household, was there talk of, you know, or was there any regret, say, with your father and mother for returning to Ireland, or was that they're fulfilling a, you know, their dream, not the American dream, but the Irish dream of being able to, you know, go back and take up, you know, their life and their lives in Ireland. Do you have any recollections
of that? Speaking only for my own family, which I think the circumstances were somewhat unique. There was four children, and my father was a very, very busy engineer. And I think he actually, even though we were based in Phoenix, and again, this was all before I was born, because I only got 2 weeks.
Yeah.
before I went back with them, or they brought me back to Galway. But my father, actually, even though he's based in Phoenix, he was posted. They used to send him around the States a lot. Like he did, he would go on particular jobs around the country. So it was very interesting, you know, that there wasn't enough balance quality of life balance in the family. So.
Yeah.
They really welcomed going back to Ireland to create that balance of and quality of life in the family. My father took a job actually in UCG in the engineering department as a lecturer, and that's how he finished out his career basically. So there's a couple of ways to look at it. My father's career could have been probably more successful as an engineer. You know, he was working for General Electric. But, you know, I think they just took the measure of everything and decided that the family life might suffer if they stayed in the States. My mother, on the other hand, never saw herself permanently in the States. She had met my father in Dublin, and basically, you know, for her, America was never going to be, you know, the rest of her life.
Yeah.
And all her family were back in Ireland. And, you know, so she really probably was the one that, you know, was the influence there in terms of us all going back to Ireland. I don't think there was any significant regret, though. You know, I can't imagine... you know, I can't imagine having a happier... Well, it wasn't always perfect, Mm-hmm. But we had a very happy upbringing in Galway. And Galway City was a wonderful town to be raised in, and I'm sure it still is.
Bit more,
you know, so all in all, it all worked out well.
You would have known, though, if we fast forward to your, coming out of Galway University, the National University of Ireland, Galway. And you indicated that there were a wave of graduates, like yourself, who had to go, east or west. What was the scene here in New York? Like when you arrived, was there a falter? Was there a welcome? Was there an Irish community, a clique, a name it, of youngsters who came here? And what was the atmosphere like, for you and your now new graduate colleagues?
Well, two things struck me when I came into New York. I had a bunch of second cousins on my mother's side, so I got a sense of family from the very beginning. And there was, one particular aunt who was an aunt had married my uncle, and he had actually passed away, back in the early 60s. But she was still around. She was always kind of the landing pad for anybody that was coming from Ireland from her family. So my first port of call in the States was Park Slope. And from then, I got to know a lot of my American cousins, and I also got to know just generally the feeling of being Irish in New York was very, very positive, and I the pride in being Irish was much stronger than I think I'd ever felt growing up in Ireland. The kind of inbuilt, kind of innate pride in heritage and everything the Irish had done in the States. But of course, I had tons of, pals that were staying in and around New York, and eventually we all sort of found our way at the time into Woodside. And from then on, it was several years of sharing apartments around Woodside and Sunnyside with people that, Galway people, and I got to know people from all over the country at that stage. But it was, as we like to say, the crack was mighty. It really was a combination of being young and adventurous, and a whole new world opened up to us. And it was just lots of adventure. So, can't put it any other way.
So you've had kind of the best of both worlds, and growing up in Galway and then coming here and doing quite well. When was there awareness of the undocumented? Obviously, a lot of people came from Ireland at that time, and there wasn't much of a, witch hunt for undocumented people, particularly from Ireland. They were minding their own business. They were very productive. When did you, recognize, or was there much chatter on the areas like Woodside and Woodlawn and what were now becoming very Irish communities with a lot of the people who were arriving? When did that become not only an issue, but when did that start to become a problem?
Well, if you go back to the 1980s, at that time, they had just gone through an amnesty, which the Irish had missed. So immigration law itself, from 1965 on, did not suit the Irish at all in terms of immigration patterns. And on top of that then was the more recent wave of undocumented arrived just too late to avail of the amnesty. So it was when a critical mass of people started to arrive between 85 and, say, 87, that you had enough people kind of, aggregating and talking, and you had enough people with, they had sort of been raised with the confidence to foment change, I suppose, and that was a combination of education was certainly a factor. Another factor was they had probably, well, I know we had been raised to think that we weren't going to be another generation that had to leave Ireland. So then all of a sudden people were in America, which was great. But realizing that doors were closed to them, being undocumented. Now, could they find workarounds back then that they can't find now? Absolutely. But at the same time, everybody understood that being undocumented would have its limitations. So as with everything else, it just started off with a bunch of people, you know, talking about it and then forming some kind of a group to take action. And very instrumental too were the people who were, I won't say older, but more senior members of the community, the more well-established community, very influential, very helpful, were people that, would have been in the United States since the 60s or before and were compassionate enough to understand that, you know, these young people deserved a chance as well. So they connected the people who are being affected, the undocumented, with an established, almost a political infrastructure here in the United States.
Yeah, and that would bring us, of course, Paul Finnegan, to, you know, the group in New York who became a political influence in the Irish immigration reform movement. And as we move on, from there, the Emerald Isle Immigration Center, which was then became, home for mostly Irish immigrants, and their primary purpose then was to see what could be done to take the political action necessary. But you came in to, as director of Emerald Isle Immigration Center, that was around 94 or so.
That's right.
Now, by that time, had there been this new awareness that, in fact, we were now in worse shape, that the Donnelly visas, the Schumer visas, the Morrison visas, that those were once off and that was it? So rather, any vision that we had or any hopes or dreams that we had, that this may continue and there'd be other batch coming from somewhere, and after all, the Irish were very productive and very welcome and English-speaking and whatever. When you took over as director of the Emerald Isle Immigration Center, what was the, what was the feeling of people around? Who came through that door, and for what reason primarily?
Well, from 94 on, the feeling was, the problem had been solved. No one really was thinking about it in terms of, was there a real solution to what we call future flow? So the typical person coming through the door of the Emerald Isle of Emerald Isle from 94, say, through 97, would have been someone who wanted to make sure their green card was properly processed. There was still, year to year, there was a significant number of Morrisons coming through, and some of them weren't taken up all in one year. They would default onto the next year. So there was a lot of help with basic processing of green cards. Not what we call full legal adjustment of status, but pointing people in the right way. And then there were those that had kind of gotten, say a Donnelly, and they were looking for citizenship. So it was actually a huge spike of people who were availing of taking out their citizenship by, say, 96, So that was a lot of the work at the time. And the feeling was, things were all right. Basically, because the guard was down, the political network got those that were should be watchdogs on these things pretty much let their guard down, and that led to the Immigration Act of 1996, who I'll talk to in a second. But I think it's typical anyway of anyone that, you know, that the immediate problem was solved, and the Irish have an optimism to them. So they're like, oh, well, the current issue is solved. We can start to build communities again. We're not living in the shadows. We can come out and fully participate in society. We won't be disenfranchised. And sure, things will sort themselves out anyway in time.
Yeah.
But that all changed because, you know, during those 2 years, first of all, the Republicans took over the House and they came in with people like Newt Gingrich and contracts with America and stuff like that. And they were particularly anxious, particularly outgunning to hurt immigration. And that's where we are today. Yeah. It all started in 94. So we kind of let our guard down on that. But where we really let our guard down was with Clinton in the White House and everything. We allowed an Immigration Act to pass in 1996, which was the first time they brought in the 3 and 10 year bars. And we don't have to get technical, but for those that don't know this, that is, you know, a severe problem for anyone that happens to be undocumented and has overstayed. And those things are still, you know, those things are on the books to this day. And from then, you know, there's law and there's enforcement, and 9/11 was the next big problem in that once 9/11 hit, you know, basically all systems improved, all tracking improved, all surveillance improved, and to the point where, you know, they could really clamp down on the undocumented. And we're seeing it play out today under the Trump administration and what's going on in terms of how they are applying the rule of law to the letter, because they have the databases, they have the systems, they have they have the manpower, so to speak, to get all that done now. So it's, you know, there was the solution to the undocumented problem of the 1980s essentially was the Morrison program. And then it was, okay, that's sorted. Sure, we'll soldier on for the time being. Everything looks rosy and everything will work itself out. Just our innate optimism, which, especially when we're in America, we're particularly optimistic. But unfortunately, the tide had already turned by 94. We didn't see it coming. 96, we didn't really see it coming. And, you know, Clinton was running for re-election around that time, and he didn't want to go near immigration. He didn't want to get into, the tangle of immigration.
Yeah,
being the expert politician that he was, you know.
Hindsight, though, Paul, I think that we have to acknowledge, you know, that Clinton was the best of them, as you say. I think
absolutely.
We had bigger expectations. With President Bush and then Obama or whatever, but it always seemed like our expectations were very high, and perhaps in hindsight too high. But we could spend the next hour talking about the flight of immigrants and indeed the uncertainty that there is. I have never encouraged, what a lot of undocumented here must be thinking when they turn on the televisions, you know, and listen to the radio, reading the newspapers about the total anti-immigrant bias that is not just local to New York, but right across the United States, and the anger and the bitterness and the spewing of the horrific bias against immigrants, and that one seems to get worse by the day. And politicians, of course, being there, but I do want to talk to you about the New York Irish Center. You hooked up with Father Colm Campbell, a Belfast native and a firebrand who actually wanted to do something else. That brings us to, you know, to Long Island City and to an area where you had a lot of senior citizens, widows, widowers, in a melting pot, you know, of ethnic groups. Queens holding, of course, the record number of varied ethnic groups. This was a service that Colum had envisioned with respect to, well, let's do something here for those documented, undocumented alike, and let's create something like akin to, say, a parish hall, a parish center of Ireland. Tell us about that, getting, you know, kicking off that, and was there a clear mission at the time, or did the mission, you know, did that change and become bigger over time?
Well, it's probably good to start the conversation talking about Father Campbell on this topic. May he rest in peace. He passed away actually 3 years ago in June. But, you know, Father Campbell came here early 90s, and he was with the Irish Apostolate, and he just sort of floated around and made himself known to people, and people got to know him, and many people, you know, he became a confidant of many, as I say, from princes to paupers, those that were destitute to those that had done extremely well for themselves in the United States in the milieu of being Irish. So, you know, he was a remarkable character. But his vision always was to create some kind of a central place for community to gather. And that is the essence of the New York Irish Center. And in that sense, it has neither changed nor expanded, but it's, you know, continues to work on being true to that. He felt New York lacked that at the time, and this is probably to late 90s.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's where, and you know, Father Campbell, again, he was, if he got something into his head, you couldn't shake it out of it. So he basically brought the right people together to create a place called the New York Irish Center. Now, why we landed in Long Island City, it probably has more to do with the fact that one of his closest friends was Paddy Riley of the Molly Wee. Paddy, rest in peace also. But Paddy said, you know, if you rent a place, you know, the way New York is going, this would have been like the early 2000s now, you know, after 3 years, your lease is going to jump so much you won't be able to keep it, so you'll be moving around, you'll fall apart, you won't have a central place for community to gather. So one thing and another, anyway, it became apparent that a property would need to be purchased, and that way you could withstand the vagaries of the property market and so on and so forth. And Joe McManus was a real estate broker that located this property we're in Long Island City on Jackson Avenue. And from there, you know, Father Campbell basically came into a rundown building, a kind of, if anyone remembers that area 20 years ago, it wasn't anything like it is today. The transformation has been astounding. It's one of the most sought-after places to live in the city. It looks out over Manhattan. It's the most beautiful view of Manhattan. The parks have been developed. There's an intense amount of high-rise luxury apartments gone up, condos, etc., all around there. It's like I look at it sometimes, I think it looks like one of those fast-growing Asian cities I've seen, you know. So that said, but the main thing was, you know, through owning a property, you know, the New York Irish Center has never been pushed out, so to speak, by a very aggressive property development market in a great location. As I often say, If you're a subway person and you're in Manhattan, you basically get on the train at Grand Central, the number 7, you get on the subway number 7, and you're at our door within 5 minutes, and you probably, you know, for all intents and purposes, feel like you haven't left Manhattan. And for the rest of Queens, it's very accessible as well, because it's on the number 7 line, which is, you know, the archery for the Irish going through Queens and so on. So it's in a great location, very central. It's very accessible from places like Greenpoint in Brooklyn also. So we haven't changed. We've developed the property over several years. Father Campbell, around the end of 2009, stepped back. He was already, I think he was coming up to 75 at the time, and looking to live out his years in comfort. He ended up back in Belfast, his beloved Belfast, eventually, where he passed away, in, as I said, in 2015. We've continued to develop the building. It's a fine asset to the community, and it is for the community. We're a meeting place and a gathering place for multiple organizations, both Irish and both, actually, we've well integrated the local population in Long Island City as well. It's a place of gathering. We have programs for kids through seniors,
all kinds of classes and music and you have computer clubs, so forth. What I'd like to do, now that we have run out of time and Kevin O'Connor is probably chapping at the bit over there, is to say that to clear up, this is not just a senior citizens club. It is extremely well supported by, as you say, God knows we won't get into a list of very successful business people here who actually contributed greatly to, the dream of Father Campbell, which you have continued very successfully. This story must continue. But let's put our listeners, and again, this is not just Queens, it's not just New York City. Mm-hmm. This serves the tri-state area, and for information, let's give the website, and this will be continued soon. Again, we'll come back and we'll talk about the services and the numerous advantages to a lot of people who may not be familiar with them. Your website?
Very simply, nyirish.org, and you can sign up for our email newsletters and get information how to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and so on. So nyirish.org. nyirish.org is the simplest way to find us. I'm going to very quickly plug two things, Adrian. I know Kevin is anxious over there in Ireland, but there is a Queen's Irish Heritage Night right by the waterfront near our centre this coming Wednesday night, July 18th. It's primarily organised by the McManus School of Irish Dance. Patricia McManus is one of our dance instructors. She's working with the local Hunters Point Parks Conservancy. It's going to be a lovely night down by the water on Wednesday, starting at 6 p.m. It'll go for a couple of hours.
And there'll be
lots of Irish performers and so on. And we'll have a table there where you can find out more about the New York Irish Centre. We're also starting a Feroiga initiative for youth. So we're trying to get youth volunteers to help us with our Feroiga program. And there's one other thing I'd like to mention. We have a partner in our building called Solace House, which is a suicide and awareness and prevention service, a fantastic service. And we'd like to create awareness of the service we provide in our building through Solace House, our partners. It is a terrible problem in all communities. I think it's the scourge of our age, suicide and self-harm. We're trying to do what we can in terms of providing a solution out of our wonderful building in Long Island City. They have a fundraiser the very same night on July 18th up in Sunnyside. It happens to be later. It starts at 7, so you can actually do both. And I plan to do both. I plan to go to the event by the water, and I also plan to go up to the wine and cheese reception at the Claret on Skillman Avenue. So we will have we have information on both those events. And please call us at 718-482-0909 if you'd like to talk to us about it or visit our website.
Paul Finnegan, again.
Stuck it in there. Thank you, Kevin, for being patient over there.
All right. Paul Finnegan there, director of the New York Irish Center.